I'd mocap that uncanny valley. In honor of The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, what's the best CGI character in a movie?
I'm Katie Rich, and I know it's not cool to like Avatar anymore, but Zoe Saldana as Neytiri is actually pretty great in it.
Hey, it's me, Dave with the Seven, the water alien from Abyss, old school style.
I am Matt Patches, even older school, I believe. I'm going with Master Control Program from Tron, because finish the game!
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I'm going with Richard Parker from Life of Pi, because I love you, Richard Parker.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 3 for Tuesday, December 10th, 2013. We just want to say real quick, thank you again to all of you who have subscribed on iTunes and written reviews. We've had a really amazing week. They've actually been highlighting us on iTunes. They seem to think we talk about politics, so we might get more rants from Dave about copyright law in the future, because apparently that's what the people want. But even if you have already reviewed or subscribed, tell your friends to subscribe, pass the word along. We have some great word of mouth right now, and we'd like to keep it going. And we appreciate all of you who have made it such a good week for us so far.
So, as I promised on a previous podcast that we don't talk about anymore, I have invited returning guest Sean O'Connell, who will probably bring up the name of said site because he is one of my favorite contributors from cinemablend.com, amongst other places. Sean, how are you doing?
I'm well. I love the new war room. So spacious.
It is. It's a lot better to wrestle in, or in our case, web-sling in, because I have brought Sean back for...
I'm sorry, what?
Boo! Oh, come on.
And that brings this segment to a close.
Stay with it, Dave. I like it.
That's right. I spent all week writing that intro, guys.
technically, didn't Spider-Man wrestle in his time? Wasn't he a wrestler?
He did. He went from wrestling to web-slinging. Did you see what I did?
That is applicable.
That had so many levels, that introduction. Anyway, but the important level that we need to talk about is the Amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer came out on the 5th of December last week. And it sort of expanded.
Dave has not slept since that moment.
No, never. I mean, I had to be frame by framing anytime I can. But last time we brought Sean in, Sean and I were talking about how they were going to be expanding this Spider-Man universe, and everybody sort of assumed as the producers were talking that was going to be more and more of that. But I don't think anybody was expecting the amount of plot that we got shoved into our first trailer. Sean, did you have any moments that really stood out for you in that reveal?
Yeah, well, and we kind of knew that it was coming. I think we'd heard it discussed or it was teased in different places, but the bold, you know, throwdown of Dr. Octopus's arms and some vulture wings and the electric eels, and just shifting the focus off of, you know, the limited discussion of is it Goblin, is it Rhino, to it's Oscorp. Like, the true villain is Oscorp over this in giant universe that's expanding. And, you know, just being able to say straight up front, you're going to get as much Goblin. And, like, there was no Electro in this trailer. Like, very little Electro, and he's supposed to be the main villain. This was all a big setup for the larger Spider-Man universe than it is really just for Amazing Spider-Man 2, because it was laying out all these pieces with Richard Parker and how much he knew about Oscorp. And whether you buy into this mythology or whether this is the big problem you had with Mark Webb's initial reboot, I think might affect how you reacted to what was being shown in the trailer. But this was Sony and this was Mark Webb saying – because this is so different from the Hall H footage, which was very Electro heavy. This was very bigger mythology heavy and pushed a lot of pieces forward that I didn't think we were going to get to see this early.
I became dizzy watching this trailer.
There's a lot going on.
There is.
Why does Dane DeHaan look like Hitler? that's what I want to know.
That's a question for his parents, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. What are you
saying?
That's
a question for the makeup
fan
team in this trailer. Not Dane DeHaan as a person, just his particular look in this film.
I think that it's really interesting to see this bold of a trailer come out of Amazing Spider-Man 2, since it's really the superhero franchise that is close enough to the Avengers and its development that it's coming out of the gate with its huge universe blowing up thing, what we're going to see later in, you know, Superman versus Batman and a whole bunch of new Terminators coming out. And of course, Star Wars rapidly expanding its universe. But I was very surprised at, I guess I would call it Spider-Man blockbuster fatigue. I saw that was some reaction to the trailer, if not the majority reaction, that was just sort of, there are too many villains, this is Spider-Man 3, the CGI doesn't look like it's improved, which I found really, I guess, puzzling to me, because to me it seemed like Mark Webb's universe is still establishing the sort of color palettes and whatnot it was working with in the first one. Did anybody here really, besides David, I suppose, really dislike the Amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer?
I'm just trying to figure out what the improvement here is, or like what the tactic to improve upon the first movie is. I know you guys liked Amazing Spider-Man. I did not like Amazing Spider-Man at all. I had a really bad time. Yeah, I had a really bad time with it, and I was hoping that this would kind of be a fix. And it seemed like Mark Webb kind of acknowledged the problems with that first movie and was going to take a different approach with this one, perhaps actually integrating the character beats with the villain stuff and I don't know, aligning stars in some way. And here, this seems like a totally different direction. Like you said, Dave, it's complete chaos, and maybe that's the reason all the special effects look really bad. I mean, it all looks like video cutscenes. It's just throwing everything at the screen, and I couldn't make any sense of it. And you, as a fan, have kind of dissected this trailer, and there's a lot there for fans to chew on. I think in email correspondence before the podcast, I talked about Graham Bass's The 11th Hour, this book that I used to read as a kid, this kind of like picture book where you're finding all the clues, and it's not really, the story is just kind of, it doesn't matter what's going on in the story. You just want to find all the little clues in the trailer. And I'm wondering if the movie is going to be that. It's just going to be one big setup for the next one, all these Easter eggs, as opposed to anything mildly coherent, which I guess is what most comic books are. We're always looking ahead in the comic books, too, and teasing things. But still, where is the coherency? Where is the character here? There's barely any Spider-Man,
maybe,
let alone Electro.
Not to play... Well, I don't even know who's actually playing here, but maybe all that stuff is in the actual goddamn movie, you know? Yeah.
Although like, they showed...
But don't you want to sell that, too? Is it important to people?
Well, Dave and Sean are seeing this movie no matter what. If they are alive and sentient beings still in May of next year, they are seeing this movie. So what I don't understand is like, yeah, I feel from what little information I have that Mark Webb might be biting off more than he can chew. I feel like if you make a not so great first installment that relies heavily on previous movie iterations and like maybe try to course correct before being like, screw it, three more movies, there's a giant universe, all these villains, let's do it. But I mean, how can you say what the movie does well or doesn't do well until you've seen the movie? I don't know.
Well, I'm sorry, Katie.
No, go ahead, Sean. I have a question that I think you're going to answer, so go ahead.
As someone who watched the trailer, you know, more times than is healthy, I do think what they did, if you go back and watch the trailer and you pay attention to it from this angle, I think what it set up is that the story going forward that Webb wants to tell, now that he's through with the origin that he felt like he had to do, is set up Peter versus Harry. This trailer is very much introducing Harry Osborn. And hopefully the movie will have a lot more time to do this, of course, but establishing who Harry is, establishing that Oscorp, for whatever reason, we're not sure yet, and I don't know, maybe we won't buy into the reason, but there's a reason that Oscorp was paying attention to Peter's development and the fact that Oscorp was paying very close attention to what Richard Parker was figuring out about Oscorp. And this trailer really did set up that Harry's now in the world, and he wasn't in the first one, and now he's the antagonist. He's going to be the back and forth with Peter. And if we see a lot of what Dave alluded to with what's going to happen to Gwen, and I don't know if you guys want to get into that, Harry's going to be the reason, and it'll be a nemesis that can carry it over multiple films. And I think that's where Webb's story can start.
I'm just wondering if any non-comic book fan, like I at least can fill in the blanks with my own Spider-Man knowledge, but if anyone sees this trailer and understands what they're watching, like I feel like what you're describing needs one of these 3.5 minute Cloud Atlas like
trailers to just be like, well, here's 18 different things that are about to happen in this movie. Here's a little context.
Yeah, the thing that I can't figure out is why I shouldn't just feel like they're trying to get on the Avengers game and be like, we're building a universe too. Look how well we can do this. And if you're someone who isn't already, primed to be excited for the Spider-Man universe, it just looks like they're trying to jump on the Avengers bandwagon and throwing a million characters at
you. Yeah, with an accelerated pace.
Well,
right?
I
watched this. I had the one of the new elements of my job sometimes are watching these trailers for the first time in large rooms of people that all want to talk about them afterwards, which is sort of a new experience for me.
Except for David.
Except for David. And so I was in a room of about 30 people when we first saw this trailer, and the reactions were almost entirely across the board incredibly negative. And this is a group of people whose favorite movies of the year are, the Iron Man 3 and World War Z variety. So I was more the anomaly than anything else. And I think that it speaks to what Katie's saying in that if you're not hardcore into the Spider-Man mythology, this does just read like a lot of derivative white noise. And I don't, the question of what the segment is about, I don't necessarily understand the tactic of going guns out, that first trailer when you could have taken a low-key approach that really spoke to Mark Webb's understanding of the character. I think sort of in the vein of that first Amazing Spider-Man trailer, like the very first one for the first movie where it was really just about Peter Parker talking to Mary Jane or Mary Catherine Gallagher, what I was going to say. Emma Stone. And,
Peter Parker's girlfriend loves to smell her own armpits. What can you say?
Right, well, you got his snark, which was different than Tobey Maguire, what Tobey Maguire wrote the character, and you got Martin Sheen and that element. Like, that's what it's like, okay, this is a different approach. And then I saw the movie and I was like, no, I've seen this before. But I think if they could focus on what makes it different, it could be more attractive because the people who notice the similarities are going to see it anyway.
I'm just, I don't know. It's puzzling to me to hear you guys' reactions because I'm much more on Sean's side where watching this trailer, I'm like, oh, the first movie was about Peter realizing that he had to take on the sins of his father, and the next movie is going to be about Peter's best friend growing up realizing the same thing, except he's going to be evil. And then we have a whole bunch of, we basically have an evil castle filled with evil dragons that are going to take him on. It seemed very simple to me, but in a comic, elevated to a comic book like PS3 cutscene level.
I'll absolutely admit to this, and this is what I've heard from the feedback afterwards. It does not feel that if you didn't like the first movie, that the second movie's selling you on any reasons to come back to it. It's playing very hard to the people who like the first one. And maybe also just hedging its bets and saying we're going to be the first one out in the summertime and we usually benefit from a bump. That's possible. But there was a strong group of people who came out and said that they liked what Webb was trying to do. They liked Andrew Garfield in the role. They liked his chemistry with Emma Stone, and they wanted to see him up the action, which you would do in a part two. So I think that trailer plays to that group. Whether that's the right decision or not, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I think we know who we're having on for our Amazing Spider-Man 2 review segment.
That's true.
Yay!
Not Sean. Not Sean. No. He's jaded.
Yeah.
He's been bought.
It's going to be David only monologuing about this movie, yes. trying to explain the plot.
I would listen to that 100 times.
Sean, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me at cinemablend.com. You can find me at Fandango. And you can find me on Twitter screaming about the Panthers losing to the Saints.
Oh.
Well, we'll leave you to that. And thank you so much for dropping by.
Thanks, guys. You're simply
the end of the year, a lot of people are already making their top 10 lists, but even though many of us write about and watch movies professionally, there is still catching up to do, and we imagine that you have catching up to do too. So in honor of the likes of you, like Dave Gonzalez, poor sap, who have not been do not have stacks of screeners in their house, we wanted to go over some movies from this year that you might want to catch up on that are all available to stream. All of our picks on Netflix. I know mine is.
Yes.
Okay. Mine is. They're all available. They're all available on Netflix. You can catch up with them right now. You don't even need fancy screeners to do it. Patches, I think we're starting with you.
Yeah, I wanted to recommend a movie that will probably not land on anyone's top 10 of the year, but would if people gave it enough thought, perhaps. It's a movie called Europa Report. It's a sci-fi movie about a mission to the moon of Jupiter, Europa. And it's a hard sci-fi movie. It's kind of a found footage movie. I don't know if I want to call it that because that comes with such a stigma, you know. So many horror movies are just running around with a camera and there's no precision, there's no artistry there. It's just like running gun filmmaking, and this is not that. I had an interesting time because Europa Report shot like 2 years ago, and I went to the set. They shot it here in Brooklyn, and on like a soundstage because they basically built out the spaceship that the action takes place in for 90% of the movie. And what they did was build cameras into the spaceship so the actors could move around and they would be blocked to kind of create shots and angles and camera movement. So it's really interesting. And it turns out it's a great film. They use a lot of archival footage as kind of set up to make this journey to Europa, this search for alien life, more tangible. And then things go awry, and they have an amazing cast of people from around the world, including Michael Nyquist, and Charlton Copley, and Daniel Wu, and Anna Maria Marinka, and just like lots of different people. It's directed by Sebastian Cordero, and it's a very unlikely, I mean, it's a sci-fi kind of horror thriller, and it's not the thing that stands out as a prestige film at the end of the year, but it's certainly one of the best movies I've seen all year, so definitely check it out. And it's on Netflix, and it's probably streaming elsewhere.
Awesome. Dave?
Boom. I'm going to go with the documentary, sort of, depending on how you mean documentaries. If you mean really interesting critical delvings into Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, then you have a very narrow definition of documentaries, good sir, but do I have a movie for you? Room 237's on Netflix. It has a whole bunch of faceless people, otherwise I'd call them talking heads, but narrating their crazy theories on Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, along with some graphics to help you see exactly what they're talking about. Some of the theories are very intriguing, such as how Stanley Kubrick is admitting that he faked the Apollo 11 moon landing, and then some of them are completely crazy, such as minotaurs on the slopes of Colorado.
No, that one, I proved that true. I communed with Stanley Kubrick's ghost in a dream last night, and it turns out that the minotaur thing is true.
Oh,
well,
good. Twist ending.
Slap my ass butt. That was not what I was expecting coming out of David. But I have talked to some people who I recommended this movie to, and they saw it on Netflix, and they yelled on me because they said that was crazy. But I say to you, good friends, expand what you think criticism is, because none of that is crazy. Room 237, Netflix, do it now.
David.
I'll go with two really quickly. One, I think everyone who's listening to this has probably at least heard of, is Francis Ha. And I guess it's worth calling attention to, like a lot of these films that are on Netflix that came out much earlier in the year, and I feel like it's always good to remind people when they're making these lists that there were movies released before October, and I think all of these movies probably were, so Francis Ha is not special in that regard, but it is a very special movie, Noah Baumbach's film with Greta Gerwig, and I think that she is being left out of a lot of the best actress conversations, and she very much deserves a place there because she completely makes that film. But the one I'm going to focus on is Carlos Regatta's Post-Tenebra Lux, which is a movie that a lot fewer people heard of than Francis Ha. It played, I think, in like New York and L.A. earlier this year. I reviewed it favorably. I'm sort of in love with it, even though now as I think back at it, I don't really remember all that much about what it's about, which has little to no impact on how much I love the film, because this film, more than most, is explicitly not really about what it's about. It's this very abstract. I have to sell this in like 30 seconds. Let's see. It's hard. It's about a guy in Mexico who relocates his family to the countryside. They're a rather rich family, and things get crazy. There are red CG demons. A guy rips off his own head. There's Neil Young sing-alongs. There's this whole rugby thing that happens.
Somehow it's crazier than the science fiction movie that I pitched at the beginning of the segment.
It
that
is.
Was possible.
I mean, it's definitely not for everybody, but I think after you watch the really stunning first scene, if you're not at least somewhat entranced, you can pass. But if you are, if there's even like an inkling there that you might want to hold on to, I would recommend sticking it through the whole thing. If you have seen Regatta's previous film, Silent Light, which is a slightly broader favorite that I really love, then you definitely should make an effort to check this out. Post Tenebra Lux. I did a shitty job of selling it, but the movie, the first scene will do a much, much better one.
Hey, and my pick is Crystal Fairy, also known as Crystal Fairy and the Magic Cactus, and 2012. It's a movie by Sebastian Silva, and it is the second movie of 2013 in which Michael Cera plays a drug-fueled monster, the other one being This is the End, which is really nothing like this. This movie got a Spirit Award nomination for Gabby Hoffman, who you might remember as the child actress from Now and Then in Field of Dreams, and probably something else I'm not thinking of. And she plays this kind of hippie girl who Michael Cera's character meets at a party, and they wind up on this road trip across Chile trying to find this hallucinogenic cactus, and they wind up taking the drugs on the beach. And it sounds like this horrible premise for a movie in which everyone's going to be obnoxious and Michael Cera's going to be an idiot. And it actually is very charming and heartfelt and really funny in parts. And Gabby Hoffman isn't great in it. She gets very naked, if that is a thing that you're interested in. And I saw this at Sundance and had pretty low expectations for it, but it was very enjoyable. It's made kind of like on the fly by this director, Sebastian Silva, while they were waiting to get another movie financed. And I greatly enjoyed it. So you can watch it on Netflix. You can enjoy that nudity in the privacy of your own home. And, you know, if you take a hallucinogenic cactus along with it, report back. I'm curious if that enhances the viewing experience.
Is there other movie Magic streaming yet?
There are other movies. I don't think so. But that one also did open
this
year.
It's definitely. I don't think it's streaming on Netflix, but given that it went straight to DVD and iTunes, you can definitely rent it or buy it on iTunes.
Yeah, I never saw that one, so I couldn't give the endorsement. It's a terrifying movie.
That gave me nightmares.
I like Crystal Fairy, but I think Magic Magic is a much better movie. So if you have the $4.99 or whatever it is to shell out for it, watch them both.
If you're really into Michael Cera.
This was a really weird segment to have after, 3 weeks ago we said that Hulu Plus was better than Netflix, but we got some weird comments about that, so there you go, Netflix subscribers, we haven't forgotten about you.
I stand by Netflix, so I'm glad we can give them a plug. We weren't planning to talk about The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, which I have enjoyed hearing pronounced on
Smaug.
Television for the last
Smaug,
couple days.
Yes, it's not smog, it is Smaug.
Yeah.
That's right.
I've enjoyed watching football announcers have to pronounce it. We weren't planning on talking about it, and then David came away from his screening of it raving about how he loved it, and having hated the first one, which you can probably hear on last year's review segment, it became a much more interesting idea for a topic. Not only because The Hobbit is a big movie, it's blah, 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 but because it's the second in a trilogy, and those typically can have a harder time feeling coherent, as we saw with Catching Fire just a couple weeks ago. So I want to hear David rave about something with CGI dragons in it, since I never thought I would live to see that day. And then B, we just kind of want to talk about this franchise in general, if we have renewed faith in it. Patches and David are the only people who've seen it, so Dave and I are going to be in the role of asking questions and saying Smaug a lot. But I want to start first by just hearing from David. David, how the hell is this movie actually that good?
Well, it's funny. I liken this movie to Mission Impossible 3, which may seem like an unlikely point of comparison, but I...
Everything is Mission Impossible 3 to you. What the
you
hell?
You do reference Mission Impossible 3 a lot.
We're not surprised you're referencing Mission Impossible 3, because you reference it every time you like a blockbuster.
Well, maybe that says a lot more about me than it does Mission Impossible 3, but I think that it is sort of a template for... and I know a lot of people feel otherwise, but for really good streamlined action films. And I think that that's not what I would call The Hobbit necessarily, or Desolation of Smaug. But I think that it sort of transposes that sort of plot mechanic on it that pace over it overlays it to Peter Jackson building the world of the Hobbit. I mean, long story short, the first Hobbit, I think I speak for a lot of people when I say that it wasn't particularly satisfying. There's a lot of bloat. It felt sort of tonally off and more than self-indulgent. And I think the decision to split it up into three films and really to make it after The Lord of the Rings rather than as a preamble to the grander story really left sort of a bad taste in everybody's mouth preemptively. And the movie didn't do very much to justify that. This movie feels a lot more confident from the very beginning. It really rushes into the story. And from the outset, it plunges you in. There's an urgency to their adventure. They have to get from point A to point B. You understand why. You understand what the stakes are. And then not only are all the characters a little bit better lived in than they were in the previous installment, but the action is really thrilling, which is something that I don't often find myself saying about Peter Jackson. There are moments in the Lord of the Rings films which I don't really think work as action films, but more as adventure films that have nice action beats. But there is a scene that a lot of people are in love with already in the middle of this movie, an escape from involving barrels and dwarves in a river that is really phenomenal stuff that is very evocative of Spielberg's Tintin movie and how it moves and flows. But I think they do a really interesting job here as you get a better sense of what the shape of the trilogy is going to be, how they are molding the book or changing the book, rather, to use this more as a proper first trilogy to the Lord of the Rings trilogy rather than something that feels a little bit more removed. You can really feel them tying the, you know, Sauron and necromancer stuff into it. There's a great Gimli reference in this one. I mean, really, for fans of the original trilogy.
There's a great Gimli reference in this movie, guys. Wait until you see Desolation of Smaug. There's such a good Gimli reference.
The movie moves very, very well. Back to my Mission Impossible 3 reference. It goes from action set piece to action set piece. There's very little fat, although some people will be less enamored with the sort of elf love affair stuff than I was. I thought it was perfectly charming. It moves very well. I got a great sense of adventure. I got a great sense of how this world is taking shape around them. And I really loved the dynamic that's set up between the river boat people. I'm not a huge Tolkien
Lake
nerd,
town.
As you can tell, but whatever. And and sleepy Smaug up in his mountain. I really felt Bilbo coming into his own. Smaug himself, my least favorite part of the film, but I really enjoy how they wrap things up or don't with him. I was just really swept up in this in a way that
that's so
I was
strange.
With the
it's I'm
with
so
the
surprised
first
by that because I don't think I mean I ultimately liked Hobbit, Desolation of Smaug, but it doesn't strike me anything like Mission Impossible 3. Because Mission Impossible 3 is, it's its own beast. It's not really connected to 1 or 2. Like you said, it's a streamlined action film, but it's also character-driven. I mean, obviously, J.J. Abrams goes out of his way to have people chatting about important things, kind of parallel, have an action scene while we're introducing character elements or twisting things.
Oh, I don't want to get into too much of a tangent, but I would argue the point that Mission Impossible 3 is character-driven.
We are clearly having a separate episode in which we'll be Mission Impossible 3 someday.
Let me pose this question. How does this sequel that you're describing that has three villains and is nothing but a whole bunch of action scenes that you ended up liking mean that you also can't enjoy Amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer?
I haven't even seen
it. Which seems to be the exact same thing.
Burn!
Well, no, because my problem with the Amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer had nothing to do with the trailer, so much as the fact that we're talking so in-depth about a movie none of us have seen. That's the problem. I said quite clearly at the beginning of that segment that we should wait to pass our judgment until we see the movie.
I want to step in here and say I didn't like... I mean, that's the problem with The Hobbit. It doesn't work because there's too much action and not enough character. I'm disagreeing with David on this one. I think it ends up stumbling upon itself because it's so much CG action and without any weight whatsoever. I wish that the Hobbit movies could be what you're describing, David, a setup to Lord of the Rings. I wish the first movie could just be the Hobbit tale and then maybe like fan fiction movies, totally not based on anything, just Peter Jackson riffing on Tolkien mythology or these other silly writings.
The original production plan was what you're talking about, Patches.
And I think that'd be ultimately more enjoyable, but I guess, you know, it would shock fans, would have them up in arms to kind of have him
create
things out of what?
I think you're exactly right. I mean, it would shock fans to sort of glide over that stuff.
My favorite part of this movie is completely made up. It is Turiel, the part played by Evangeline Lilly, who is a Mirkwood elf who fancies Killy the dwarf and
the hottest
is struggling.
Dwarf, you may remember.
Yes, the hot elf falls for the hot dwarf, and she's struggling
with her identity.
Not
the Aragorn dwarf.
What? Oh no! Yeah, the Aragorn
when
one.
When he feels obliged to be at the whim and mercy of the material, I think his films suffer for it. I think that's why the first chapter was a little bit bloated. But obviously, when he invents his own additions to the Middle-earth universe, he really commits to them and has a lot of fun with them, because the Tauriel character is not functional just because she has this cute romance, but because I think the cute romance is there in order to have her more appropriately featured as this badass fighter in these great action sequences.
Sure. But the other thing is, she has something going on, whereas I feel like the dwarves, I know what they want from the first movie, and it's still what they want, and they're kind of just rolling along. It's like beat from beat. We go back to this video game comparison. It's so old to call an action movie, oh, it's like it's operating like a video game, but here I really did feel like I was going level to level, kind of mashing the A button to get through dialogue trees just to be like, I just want to keep playing. Let's go to the action.
I want to make a point here, I want to say that
Katie, you were talking about that there's some sort of struggle for a second movie, for a sequel, and I'm kind of trying to figure that comment out, because here I think Desolation of Smaug runs into a problem where it just feels like an extension of the first movie. I'm still just kind of going along on this trip to the mountain to find Smaug, the thing that was introduced beat one in
Smaug.
I feel like this trilogy is really about the adventure, and I think the first part, even though I love the parts in the Lord of the Rings films where they're setting it up and you're really getting a feel for who these people are and what they're fighting for, I feel like the real meat here is in the journey itself and not really in setting up what it's about or what's happening. I mean, I think that's why we meet them at full flight in this one. And even though it did feel like they were progressing in levels like a video game, I think there's something to be said for these films that are about, you know, going over one obstacle and the next from point A to point B, especially if the world and the stakes widen and deepen around them as they do that. And I found all the individual set pieces to be rather thrilling in a way that I didn't think they were in things like King Kong or the original Hobbit film, because, I mean, I thought the sequence in the forest was a lot of fun. I thought revisiting – it's not the Mines of Moria, was fun.
There's a lot of sameness compared to something like Two Towers, where at least there you have parallel action. Like, it can feel like the same adventure in that movie as opposed to a sequel like Empire Strikes Back that feels kind of individual. Or Two Towers at least runs on, you know, the parallel action, lots of gears in motion. Here, Jackson tries to push this story to have multiple gears and juggling a bunch of ideas and plot lines at once. It just kind of all flops back into itself, and it's just not a good example of a sequel to me. It's not really pushing the story or spreading it out so that maybe it can collide again in the third installment.
And I do want to talk a little bit more about sequels in general, but I do want to say, as to the parallel action, I wanted to ask you, at least, because something that I thought was so interesting was how the side story with Gandalf sort of going meeting the necromancer and his forces and whatnot,
yeah,
and how that was weaving this in with the Lord of the Rings films. And that really worked for me as well, because it sort of added this urgency and this familiarity in a good way, and that, like, it's deepening the mythology of this whole world in a way that I, as a viewer of the films but not a hardcore reader of the books, still understood.
I think,
did that not work for you?
I know, it definitely did. I was intrigued by that. And I like, you know, as silly as Radagast the Brown was in An Unexpected Journey, at least here's, like, a new character who's bringing something to Gandalf and pulling him in a new direction. It's a hint of parallel action. But this, that feels tacked on in Desolation of Smaug. And I wonder if it's because this was conceived as two movies and has become three. I don't feel like Desolation of Smaug lags. But it does feel like it feels rushed, and it feels kind of muddled and plopped in the middle of whatever the dwarves and Bilbo are doing. It just doesn't feel as elegant as the way Two Towers was moving back and forth. And again, I wanted more of it. I think that what Jackson does to kind of expand on Tolkien lore and have this connective tissue to Lord of the Rings is so fascinating, and he just can't devote the time necessary to make it interesting, even though it's intriguing, if that makes sense. I mean, I like, and Gandalf is a fun character. He gets to kick some ass and he gets thrown around and, you know, we get a little bit of fan service, but it's just not enough to make it really compelling. It's not involved, but it's interesting or it's intriguing.
Hey, Katie.
What's up?
As somebody who also hasn't seen The Hobbit, I know because of the kind of nerd that I am that I'm going to have to see every Peter Jackson Hobbit movie. Is there a world where you could skip the middle part of the, like, the Desolation of Smaug?
No, I was thinking about doing it, and then I kind of realized basically the same thing. Like, I, even though The Hobbit didn't do that much for me, I loved the experience of watching the Lord of the Rings movies so much, and I had not really read the books. I'm not a high fantasy person for the most part. I feel like I'm going to want to revisit this world, even if the pieces that I'm experiencing while I'm in it are kind of frustrating, because there are things in The Unexpected Journey, like the whole scene with the trolls trying to eat them over the spit. There's bits that work so well, that work in a way that basically nothing else does. I think Peter Jackson is really good at inhabiting these set pieces, basically. Although I completely buy what you guys are, what Patches you're saying about the way that it doesn't feel like it's all holding together. It feels like it's more of the same.
Well, Katie,
well, I mean, I still want to have the me and Katie side of this conversation.
Well, no, I wanted to throw it to Katie because I think, you know, off podcast we discussed the compulsion to see these sequels, to want to see more, whether they're, and I wonder if that's because they're connected, it's one long adventure like Hobbit, or if we feel the same way about just arbitrary sequels like the Marvel movies or the Mission Impossible movies. And so if Jackson is stringing us along so that we feel involved the whole way, I mean, is that a tactic? Is that a storytelling tactic that works in Lord of the Rings' favor, or I don't know.
Well, I can't imagine going to see what's that third one called? There and Back Again. I can't imagine going to see that and not having been introduced to Smaug the way you're supposed to be, because that character is interesting. Like, I still remember them pretty well from reading The Hobbit in eighth grade. Like, why would you not want to get in on the first part of that for this character who seems intriguing and who, I mean, based on reports, actually does really work really well? Like, you're basically depriving yourself of a part of the story that would be rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing that I can't, or that I have to justify to myself, is why I could not see The Desolation of Smaug and get it on DVD or whatever in time for There and Back Again, and is that going to end up, you know, saving me 48 FPS 3D screening / you know, my butt falling asleep time?
Oh, I see. So not seeing it, but seeing it a year from now.
I mean, do I have to shell out a significantly larger portion of my Christmas money when I could spend my tax refund getting it on DVD or Blu-ray?
It's hard for me to recommend Desolation of Smaug like that, because I want you to see it on the big screen, and because Jackson does do some crazy action stuff in this movie, I mean, he's one of the few people that I'd say just see whatever he makes, because he really pushes the imagination. It's... I mean, the Tintin comparison for the barrel scene is very apt. There's some crazy stuff that he's able to achieve here. But ultimately, I'm like, I don't know if you want to spend money to do it. That's a hard. But you need to see it on the big screen.
Well, you know, that's neither here nor there. I had a great time. It was one of the most fun experiences I had at a theater this year. I saw it in glorious 24 frames per second 3D. It was bright and beautiful. And it was exactly the kind of movie experience I'm looking for in December. But what I mean to say more to the point is... you know, this culture of having to see all these various installments, it's a idea of completion where they instill this drive in you to really feel like you are consuming every part of the experience. And it's impossible, whether or not you see it on DVD or see it in theaters, to pull yourself out of that. And I'm wondering, what's the breaking point? Like, I didn't like The Hobbit, but for me it was a non-issue of whether or not I was going to see Desolation of Smaug. And, you know, it's part of my job, so I didn't have to make the choice to spend $15 to see it. And that's going to be a factor for a lot of people. But I wonder, you know, what at what point do we contend and confront with our feelings of needing to be a part of that conversation? Like the first Marvel movie I didn't see was Thor 2, because after the Avengers, I felt like, okay, I've seen enough. I don't need more of this right now. But I'm wondering, you know, what's the breaking point for people? Can somebody not see this movie? I don't know.
I feel like, I mean, it's harder with stuff like The Hobbit. With Marvel movies, I think it's easier. But if you, like, I would never recommend one Hunger Games movie to people, even if the last two come out and they're kind of crappy. Like, those movies were never built to operate individually. Or, like, I don't know. I typed in our off-show Skype chat while David was talking, is that he sounds a lot like I did coming back from Attack of the Clones, and just sort of being like, I didn't hate that as much as I was expecting to hate that, which is fine, but that's also one of those situations where you could have not watched Attack of the Clones and the Star Wars story wouldn't, even the prequel story wouldn't have been that much altered from how it was. So, I mean, it's hard to tell because I'm definitely in for all three Hobbit movies. I'm just not sure if I'm into them for a theater for, you know, some sort of
It's funny. The ultimate time. Credit The ultimate credit I can give Desolation of Smaug is that I've seen the Lord of the Rings films 900 times, and yet this afternoon while I was working, I went out of my way, got my Blu-ray, put it on, and watched The Fellowship of the Ring. And there's a scene in The Fellowship of the Ring that I'd never noticed before where Bilbo is talking about the trolls that were arguing about how to cook them and ended up being petrified by the sun, which is something that happens in the first Hobbit film, and made me appreciate the entire thing more as a whole.
Oh.
Even though I will not make the effort to go back and watch The Hobbit again. That's
so funny, because that's also what you were making fun of me for the Amazing Spider-Man 2 trailer. But that's okay. You just have all the same tendencies as me.
He doesn't want to admit how similar he is.
My only thing was talking about movies before you've seen them. That's how does that have anything to do with what I'm saying?
I'm just saying that the Easter eggs, the large CG multiple villain action piece things.
Those are things that I tend not to dislike, but that's not what I was mocking you for. What I was mocking you for is it's unfortunate it came across as mockery at all, but it's just, you know, what gets my goat about everyone are obsessing about these movies that are 3 years away when there are so many great movies you can see right now.
But isn't like, the Desolation of Smaug?
We're not, that's not what we're talking about either. We're talking about a movie that...
That you brought it up!
I'm just saying, it takes all kinds, David. It takes all kinds of fans for these large franchises to move on.
This year's Christmas miracle is David realizing he's like Dave.
Of Smaug. No, the credits to Desolation of Smaug that it allowed me to tap into, or forced me to tap in at any level, even if it's not at all pertinent to what Dave was talking about, fandom.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, though, that whatever music break we're coming up on, it's going to be horrible because the keyword's desolation, and that just does not lead to happy music.
I think you should make the keyword Smaug and see what comes up.
So we have said nothing significant about sequels. But we have made it clear that we are of two minds about The Hobbit 2. But I think that's better than could be expected. I think that after last year, maybe even though I'm the one who's championing it, I can say that it's better that anyone likes this sequel.
I liked Unexpected Journey more than Desolation of Smaug.
But you are ridiculous.
I don't care if people fight me on that. We all have our own opinions. I enjoyed the comedy more. I enjoyed all the craziness of Unexpected Journey. Desolation of Smaug is just a little too bland. I'm sorry.
You enjoyed dwarves washing dishes more than most
singing songs but and being just... funny. I'm sorry. I thought it was a riot.
My favorite part of The Hobbit, the first film, was towards the end, where I was more into it as it ended than I was when it started, and I thought that the final beat of the previous film, where we end on Smaug, Smaug's eye, was enough to say, like, okay, despite despite knowing better, I'm going to go back.
You
and
liked
see
the promise.
One.
You didn't like the lead up. You
did,
just liked
did
the
you,
promise. There's not enough Bilbo in Desolation of Smaug. That's my problem.
Did you feel at the end of Desolation of Smaug, without revealing how it ends, were you again, despite your overall feelings of the film, geared up for the
There's
next
no
final
way not to be.
Film?
It's scientifically created. It's chemically created so that you have to come back and see the third chapter. You have to. I mean, and that's what all movies are doing. It's funny that we're talking about this with the Spider-Man conversation at the head, because those movies are just this whole world-building effort that everything in Hollywood is leaning towards. It's not to create, like, a great community or an expansive world that's better for storytelling. It's better for, like, convincing your brain subconsciously to need to see all the installments. It's just science. So, yeah, you have to see There and Back Again.
Yeah.
There and... Desolation of Smaug, number one at the box office because of science.
That does it for today's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back on Friday with a review of American Hustle, which is the new movie from David O. Russell. In the meantime, tell the people who you are. It rhymes. Yes, it does.
I am Matt Patches. I write on the internet where at places like, I don't know, Grantland and Vulture and IGN and Film.com sometimes. And you can find me on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And remember, as we said in the beginning, we are on iTunes. We're up and running. And we've gotten a lot of momentum. It's been great. All of you listeners, you know, going out there, subscribing again, leaving reviews and nice comments. And if you have not yet, please head to iTunes. Make it happen. And let's get more people talking. It's a great conversation. And the people ahead of me are going to tell you how you can communicate with us and make it one big party. Yeah.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of Film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at Film.com, where you can... yeah, that's enough. I don't need to pimp myself any further, but I can pimp all of us, where you can find us all on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room, where we are there with renewed vigor in much the same way as we are back on iTunes starting from the ground up. Join the conversation. We're happy to talk to you.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. I spell that first part DA7E, which is also my Twitter handle. You should come to fightinginthewarroom.com. Each one of our posts has some comments. We got some really good lists from people listing their Harry Potter movies from worst to best that I enjoyed this week. And every episode has a place where you can give us feedback to make each episode better. But if you want to contribute in terms of the content to the episodes, I would say give us a call and leave us a voicemail at 914-410-6450. Fighting in the War Room.
I love it when Dave sings. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at Vanity Fair's Hollywood blog, where I'm actually writing now about very silly things so far. You can also find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KATEYRACH. You can also find our entire show on Twitter at FITWR, Fitwer, if you want to say it that way. You can use our Twitter handle to answer this week's lightning round question, which is...
In honor of The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, what's the best CGI character in a movie?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you on Friday.
And if he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light. If he stays, I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light. If he stays, then I'll wait for him in the morning. I'm a thousand pieces of light.